And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. We're back this week with the regular crew, and we have two topics that are actually quite topical. First, we're going to talk about something you probably heard a little bit about if you run in these circles, Kickstarter, the possibility of fan-driven projects to continue beloved series. Then we'll talk about the sitcom SmackDown, the idea of a bracket to determine the greatest sitcom of the last 30 years. We'll respond a little to that and to the general idea of setting pieces of art against each other. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson.
Hello.
What do you do for NPR?
I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And I'm very happy to see you back from South by Southwest.
Good to be here.
Buddy.
You know, on the show, it's like I never left, but it feels like weeks have passed.
It's true. And Trey Graham back this week. What do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and TV and pop culture and theater and that sort of thing for NPR.org.
Wonderful to see you as well. And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And you are back from?
I am from Barcelona.
Barcelona.
Yes. And as I was coming back through the TSA screening, they ask you questions.
Sure.
And the guy was, came in through JFK, so he was like, so should I go? My wife and I were thinking of going to Barcelona, maybe.
That's how everyone talks.
Exactly. And I said, yeah, man, it's like if you're sitting in this cafe looking up at the cathedral and there's a woman there singing opera, and across the plaza there's a guy accompanying her on Spanish guitar, and you're just smelling your cafe con leche, it's like Europe exploded. And I thought, maybe that's not a word to use in the TSA screening.
Yeah, but it went okay for you because you're here.
4 hours later.
Now. Yeah.
No, it was fine. It was brilliant. You'll hear more about that later in the podcast.
Well, I'm awfully happy to see everybody. And while we were all sleeping, I guess, Kickstarter. Okay, well, let's see. Many years ago, in the early ages of cult television on the internet, the teen noir, I would call it, Veronica Mars, had a... Mm-hmm. According to me, wonderful first season, followed by two more seasons.
Two other seasons.
It is beloved by a small but loud community of people who have always been very unhappy that it only lasted three seasons. And the creator, Rob Thomas, who also created Party Down and some other neat stuff.
He was also great in the band Matchbox 20. Hi-oh!
Different Rob Thomas. And the star, Kristen Bell, who has gone on to do a bunch of other things. Got together and ran a Kickstarter campaign in which they asked for $2 million for a Veronica Mars movie. They raised their $2 million in the first day, and they're currently a little under $3.7 million from a little under 56,000 people. That's when I looked. It's currently Monday. And when I looked, the average came out to an average donation of about $65. So, and that is made up of a lot of really small donations and then some very, very large ones.
And included, benefits such as if you donate, was it $10,000, you'd have a cameo or something like that? There were ways that you could participate in this movie in a very permanent way.
And also a certain number of people at a certain level, you would get a digital download of the movie, which theoretically would mean you wouldn't have to pay for a ticket in the theatrical release that they are trying to do. I don't know how broad of a theatrical release they're actually going to pull off. But a digital download and or I think there's DVDs and...
The usual range of premiums that you get with any Kickstarter project.
Right, exactly. Or, say, pledge levels, for example. Yes. I mean, as an NPR podcast, we should say that this model is akin to the public media model. The typical public media model is, we do this thing, that's A, and if you like this thing we do, support it.
Right.
So it's based on... affirming, I like this thing, or if you want to be more cynical about it, it's about guilt. I like this thing, therefore I should support it. Kickstarter and crowdsourcing in general is more about, we want to do a thing, and with your help, it can happen. So it's more aspirational, it's more based on fear. If I don't do this, this won't happen.
Mm-hmm.
They're related.
But at the same time, a lot of Kickstarter campaigns, and a lot of the ones that I've followed, are going for a certain ceiling. At this point, the
right.
project will happen. Because if you don't reach your goal, the project doesn't happen. Like, the people don't give the money.
Right.
But, it reaches a certain point. At a certain point, people sail above it. I mean, the limit on Veronica Mars was $2 million. If we raise $2 million, this movie will happen. And it's now raised $3.7. So there are people who are not motivated by guilt or fear,
right.
but a desire to make the project the best it can be and to feel historically attached to it.
Right.
Yeah. My first encounter with Kickstarter was when a guy who had designed some industrial design accessories and whatnot for companies like Belkin, and maybe had freelance for Apple or something. I don't know. But he created this watch band thing that you could plug your Nano into, and it would be a watch, and it just clipped in. And I thought that was the cutest thing in the world, so I pledged money and got one for my then-partner for Christmas.
And my first experience with Kickstarter was I was at a party and met Yancey Strickler, who's one of the co-founders of Kickstarter, and he explained it to me in very excited and earnest detail how incredibly altruistic it was and how excited. He had quit some, you know, real job and was suddenly sinking everything into his belief that this was going to change the world. And I stood there, as one does, and thought he could I think that might work.
Yeah.
And I've never I had never met him before and have never met him since, but God bless him, I felt like I was part of something in that conversation.
And I've also taken part in a Kickstarter. I'm one of the reasons that a Thrilling Adventure Hour concert film is going to happen, and for my donation I will get a script marked up by one of the actors, and the satisfaction that comes with having a thing that I dearly want to have happen. Now, the criticism this kind of thing has gotten, and this particular Veronica Mars project has gotten, is that Kickstarter formed and crowdsourcing formed around the idea of there's an existing infrastructure of funding, and this is a way to get around that. Mm-hmm. So that things that wouldn't normally rise to the level of getting made because of all the inherent biases, limitations of the existing system, just would be gotten around. So this ties in, Stephen, somehow with the Jonathan Coulton model. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's similar, yes?
Absolutely. And I think that, well, and you could also say the Amanda Palmer.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, in terms of certain artists who, they're not necessarily mainstream stars, but what they have is a sort of medium-sized but incredibly intense following.
Right.
And people who buy into them not only as artists but as personas.
Now, you could say that this is a natural outgrowth of the fandom phenomenon, something that a woman who is sitting in the back of this studio knows a hell of a lot more than, say, anybody else in this room.
That person being my mom.
Exactly.
She's in the room.
So we've gone from a time of passively absorbing pop culture and sort of idly speculating mm-hmm. about it. I don't think there was Fibber McGee and Molly cosplay. I don't think there was...
Now, you know, you don't know that.
Jack Benny and Rochester / fiction. There might have been. But we've gone from a time of where these of obsessively claiming a thing that you love and making your love of it a part of your identity, which is something you used to do as a kid exclusively, and then you put away childish things. Now
unless you're my mom.
Unless you're your mom or the people who followed her into this kind of fandom. So now, you could say that this is a natural outgrowth of that. But a criticism I've read online about this is that this is how you get increasingly insular projects.
This is the note that I had. Is this, when does it become so insular that mediocre artists are making mediocre art for a slavishly devoted bunch of fans? And when does it become an echo chamber? You know, just as in the realms of politics and cultural affairs, people now can discuss the world and all its charms exclusively in the company of people who already think the way that they do.
I think that's a very serious concern on one hand. On the other hand, mediocre artists were making mediocre art, and mediocre artists will always make mediocre art in every conceivable iteration imaginable. I know there are downsides to it, but to me, the good of this sort of thing so outweighs the bad. As a fan of artists who would otherwise be having a hard time eating mm-hmm. and continuing to make art, we have mentioned Clem Snide and Yves Barzelay on this show. I have mentioned Clem Snide and Yves Barzelay on the show a million times. He funded that EP of Journey covers, and you know, several times over via Kickstarter. A band I love called Shearwater wanted to package their album, which was already coming out on a label, but wanted to make a version of it that came with a 75-page dossier full of found art, and it's this beautiful thick booklet, and they needed to raise $7,500. They did it on Kickstarter. A band I love called the Helligoats funded their latest record on Kickstarter. And as, for example, the music industry shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, some of these artists who might have made $100,000 from a label to make a record are now getting offered $10,000 to make a record, split five ways.
All right, I will now be a terrible person.
Okay.
Here's my problem. It's not even a problem. Here's where I am given pause by this a little bit. To me, there is a difference between a patronage model in which you say, I'm going to support this artist in continuing to be able to eat. I'm going to support this band, which says they're going to go and make a new record, right? where your primary goal is to free up the artist to do the art. There's a difference for me between that and what feels more to me like a go into the restaurant and order up what you want model.
Right.
Here's where I got really a little bit squirmy about this. Alan Sepinwall at HitFix ran an interview with Rob Thomas after this had been such a success. And here's part of what Rob Thomas said in response to a question about, you know, which characters would come back and which would not. There was a real internal debate for me about what kind of movie I wanted to make. Just by way of example, I really enjoyed Side Effects and that sort of noir thriller that I could see Kristen Bell as Veronica Mars in something like that. I liked the plotting of that movie. I had some desire as a filmmaker to take Veronica in a slightly new direction and do something adventurous with her. Or there's the give the people what they want version. And I think partly because it's crowdsourced, I'm going with the give the people what they want version. It's going to be Veronica being Veronica and the characters you know and love. Certainly, I think I can make a fun, great movie out of that, and I'm excited about that. But it was a creative debate I had within myself, and I finally made the decision that I'm happy with it to go with, let's not piss people off who all donated. Let's give them the stuff that I think they want in the movie. This, nope, to me, is coming dangerously close to, I will pay you money. I mean,
you mean like,
I'm going to say something horrible.
This is the new boss same as the old boss?
Well,
that it's no different from a studio.
At what point is it misery? Do you know what I mean? Like, at what point are you taking the creator and saying, I want you to make the story that I want to hear? How far are we from somebody saying, I want to pay for a Veronica Mars movie where X and Y get married? Right? Mm-hmm. There is something about it that to me is not the same as taking an artist and supporting the artist to go do the art. To me, when you start to have people ordering up a specific project that you know is based on, super fans in charge of creative just freaks me out number of levels.
I'm going to push back just a little bit and say that I don't think I heard him say quite that. That he sort of considered a range of options and he chose what he thinks the audience is going to want, right?
And he chose, let's not piss people off who donate.
Sure, but so did every Renaissance artist who had a major patron, right? They could have painted anything, and they painted a whole lot of frescoes of the Virgin.
Okay. I think there's something to that. I think where you get around that, this is one of many potential pitfalls of this funding model. And I think the way that you get around that, at least hopefully, is it involves probably a little bit less surprise, I think, is part of what, Linda, what you're getting at, right, is that you are not necessarily freeing the artist to surprise people.
Well, you're not
The artist has to state up front what they're going to give you.
You're not always supposed to get exactly what you want right this minute from a piece of art. That's
right.
Really unfortunate to me. If you put super fans in charge of plotting The Office, Jim and Pam would have gotten married in the fifth episode.
Right.
You get no payoff. It is part of art, especially serial storytelling. It is part of serial storytelling to deny you for a certain period of time the thing that you are craving. And it is really frustrating to me, the idea that we're going to go in the direction of saying, well, there's no other way to do this, so the fans are going to do it, and my job is going to be to not piss off the fans because they're funding it. And there are a bunch of things about it that give me pause. I'm not against it. I don't not like it. I'm not unhappy that they're doing it. But I think it gives me pause, and I felt during the time that this came out, like you could not even have that conversation. You could not even say, here are my concerns about it, because there was all this kind of, why can't you just be happy for us? And why are you trying to ruin our happiness and ruin our fun? It's not my job as a person who writes about culture to make you feel happy about your choices. Like, it's okay to ask questions. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all these things are misplaced and none of this is going to be an issue. But I feel like these are questions that we have to be able to ask. There has to be able to be a conversation about it. And I felt like that conversation just got squashed, and everybody who had any concerns about it, it was, you don't understand capitalism, you don't understand art, you don't understand fans, you're trying to ruin people's excitement. And it's like, I just want that conversation about these models to happen.
No, and I feel you there, because I have been the one person criticizing a project everyone loved. Yes, I'm with
it's
you.
Not, it's
I
not, feel I'm you. Not even against it. I'm not opposed to it. I just want to be able to ask the question. And to me, the momentum with which it became impossible to ask these questions is related to the fact that it's powered by fans and fandom, and it gets going with a lot of momentum, and you can't pause and ask a question, and that's all that I'm saying.
Yeah, well, that's another reason why this is interesting. I mean, everybody's talking game changer, game changer, game changer. It will be something that's fascinating to watch, A, because of, you know, the fact that it happened, but B, what comes of it? So will it be mere fan service? That's something I'm very, very curious about. And I was trying to think back. We owned the first season. I liked the second and third seasons. Was what I loved the characters and their relationships, or was it this plotting, the twists and turns and the...
Oh, should it be a movie versus a TV show?
This is the thing. So, I mean, it was inevitably going to be different.
Right.
Because it's not this sort of slowly unfolding thing where characters change subtly and change completely by the time a season's over. By turning it into a film, you're making it into a different thing already. So there's a lot of questions. I'm curious to see where it goes.
Well, you raise a great point, and I think Linda does too. What happens when people pony up a whole bunch of money for something they flat don't like? And that could be a movie, it could be a book, mm-hmm. it could be an album, mm-hmm. it could be any number of things. And the fact of the matter is, I mean, caveat emptor. And I look at it, you know, always from great more art. Great,
of course,
great people eat. And that's not contradicting anything that you're saying, Linda. You're not contradicting anything I'm saying here. But we're still all new to this. You know, this is still a fresh thing. And I think the excitement of ownership somewhat changes the way people interpret the quality of the thing that they're supporting, because they are supporting the artist as much as the art.
Right.
But as we go along, if this becomes more and more the way all these things are funded, you know, as a super fan of an artist I support on Kickstarter, if I'm bitterly disappointed in the outcome, I don't know that we've necessarily seen that happen yet.
Well,
right. On a large scale.
You know, it's not all fans by any stretch of the imagination, but there are certain projects where one of the real issues that stalks the project is fan entitlement.
Yeah.
And I am very mm-hmm. concerned about expanding and really ultimately justifying fan entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned about that. I'm concerned about a bunch of other stuff. I'm concerned about creators of TV shows not being motivated to write an ending, because mm-hmm. you could maybe just, why would I write a good ending for my show when I might be able to drag it into a Kickstarter movie or something like that? I don't want to hurt my Kickstarter movie chances, so maybe I won't give a satisfactory conclusion to my mm-hmm. mystery series, because then everybody will pay for a movie. I'm not against it. I understand how excited they are, and there's no question that if you think this show was as special as a lot of people think it was, and I don't necessarily think it was, and I freely admit that,
mm-hmm.
then your feelings about it will be different, and your feelings about this particular project will be different. These are all just things that going forward are...
Yeah. And some things end when they do for a reason.
Well, sure. Exactly. Some things... I've said my thing.
I am comforted by the fact that, generally speaking, you don't get passionate about a thing that doesn't challenge you, that doesn't excite you. I mean, yes, JCPenney has a Facebook page, and there's lots of people who go on there loving JCPenney. And there's, I'm sure Melba Toast has like, Melba Toast now! But the mainstream things are going away. And these niches are the kind of the new way of interacting with the things that you feel strongly about. So how it's going to shake out, I don't know, but I'm really fascinated to watch it.
We can all just burrow farther into our little holes and hang out with the people who like the things we already love.
That
and
yep. is a very
fun
real,
more seasons of them forever.
It's a very real possibility.
Ever going out and finding new things to
find. I do think, you know, I don't disagree with you. I didn't mean to sound like I disagreed
no,
with you about
course.
The perils of
and
fan entitlement. I just wanted to point out
that
one particular risk had been there all along.
No, sure, of course. Of course.
It really does depend, I think, to a large extent, on the artist's backbone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think those two things are related, though. I think what Glenn just said about art that challenges you, if the fans insist on getting what they want and the artist is sort of, well, I can do that, then he's not going to put his heart into it, and maybe the product is going to be disappointed, and maybe the fans are going to come back at him the way Stephen was talking about.
Yeah, I don't
and know. Then the whole thing is going to implode.
I'm happy people are happy. I think there are things that are
No, you're not. Well, and I'm you hate happiness.
Well, no, I mean, okay, I'm a and this is not a this is not a Kickstarter project, but I'm a gigantic Arrested Development fan, mm-hmm. and I'm the Arrested Development fan who's sitting there going,
"You're not the only one.
I hope those new episodes are good because that's going to really bum me out if they're mediocre." You know, it's not Kickstarter, but it is a similar sort of thing where something has been dragged back through the force of will of a few people. So, you know, there are always going to be pitfalls. My fingers remain crossed.
And my blood ran cold when I read in that same piece that Rob Thomas got a call from Brian Fuller, the Pushing Daisies guy. It's like, oh, no.
And now Zachary Levi says he wants to make one for Chuck. And it's just, I just have concerns, that's all.
I have concerns.
Well, I just hope some great art comes from it.
No matter how bad or how good any of these projects turns out to be, it's not going to be as bad as the new Star Wars movies.
There's a good point. That's a whole different problem. The question of whether you really want more of the thing you loved before, that's a whole different show. We'll do that some other time.
That's a good topic.
Yeah, we'll do that again, too. So speaking of controversies that have moved us all this week, Vulture at New York Magazine has been running this sitcom smackdown where they started off with 16 sitcoms from the last 30 years. And they set up a bracket. And the way they did it is sort of somewhat arbitrary in the sense that...
You mean a bracket?
A different... Well, no. But each matchup was done by a different writer, which means a person who chose something in a later round might have knocked it out earlier or whatever.
Sure. Just to underline that this is a goof, guys.
Exactly. Right. It's a goof.
No one sensibility at work here.
There is no reason to be actually bothered by any of
them. And yet...
But it does make for an interesting set of conversations.
Right,
and I think the first really big one was about the fact that Starley Kine, who I am a big fan of,
sure.
wrote an essay in which Sex and the City beat 30 Rock, which I
still
am having trouble processing over here. But she's so smart. I get it. I get that there are people who love Sex and the City way more than I do. But in the final round of the bracket, which posted today, Matt Zollerseitz, who is Vulture's TV writer.
And another person we like.
Matched up The Simpsons and Cheers. And wrongly.
And Linda and I became no longer friends.
He chose The Simpsons, which means that The Simpsons has now been named the best sitcom of the last 30 years.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. There are some good arguments here. There are some...
Which, to me... was crazy. I mean, I'm not... The whole point of this, the reason we wanted to talk about this is not to talk about the fact that, like, Linda doesn't like The Simpsons as much as Steven, although it's true.
Right. It will come to that.
Well,
it
was, and I also want to make the point, like, and I say this about all sorts of things. I was just saying this about empathy the other day. When people thought that Lil Wayne was going to die, I was just, like, cracking my knuckles, getting ready to do my usual I can be sad about two things argument.
Right, sure.
When people, you know, inevitably declare that it is not a big deal
right,
that this person
course.
Is that, you know, I can like two shows.
Right.
I can love Cheers with all my heart and also love Simpsons with all my heart because my heart's so big.
No, you can't. The reason why we wanted to talk about this was really to talk about sort of the subjectivity of things like this because to me, sure. I saw Alan Sepinwall this morning retweet Matt Seitz's tweet saying that he had done this. And Alan's comment was, you know, Matt Seitz, whatever, is the judge and reaches the only possible conclusion.
Oh,
so no. I clicked on it thinking, obviously, it will be Cheers. And then I went, and it was The Simpsons. And honestly, I just dropped my teeth because to me, it's The Simpsons. I mean, I get it. It's funny. It's fine. But I would never pick it over something like Cheers or... I mean, you and I, it isn't a cartoon.
And you and I have certainly had this kind of debate. You are more of a live action sitcom person. I am more of an animated sitcom person. Because I'm so very smart.
You don't have to engage with actual people.
Right.
What?
I prefer drawings to humans. I thought your post backing up your. Incorrect assertions was as always marvelously written. I disagreed with many of the arguments that you made. You had sort of said, you know, The Simpsons tends not to access emotional places as effectively.
Completely wrong.
I weep every time Dustin Hoffman as the substitute teacher hands, I may not even be able to get through talking about it without just tearing up when he hands her the piece of paper and it says, "You are Lisa Simpson."
But this is the same one moment people have been telling me about all day.
No. Oh my God, no.
Same one. All day. "You are Lisa Simpson." Makes me cry every time. You are literally the... This is the moment everyone keeps telling me about. It's so
I believe one of Linda's other primary arguments is that The Simpsons, no matter how deep you go, is basically a derivative work.
Oh, now, Trey, you will have to have watched at least one freaking episode of The Simpsons before you can weigh in on this.
That is
this
why I attributed it to Linda.
It was sort of something that I said.
Well,
I don't
you
think
can
I would
parrot what others say.
I don't think I would have said it was a derivative work.
It is a satire of the sitcom. It is a sitcom with more calm than sit. However, Cheers has more sit than calm. Would you agree with that?
I think Cheers has both.
And I think they all both have both.
I think there's a difference. I think The Simpsons, there are lots of laughs and lines and points and moments, and I think Cheers...
You're looking for the word jokes.
Jokes. I think that Cheers has set up more just phenomenal set pieces that build and build and build and are funnier and funnier and funnier as they go along. I think that Cheers is an absolutely masterful show.
Making quotability a criteria for either one. Zeitz was like, "It's very quotable. People quote it. I quote it a lot.
Cheers
my friends
is quotable,
quote it
too."
Cheers is one of the most quotable.
But it's not quoted nearly as dudes sitting around quoting The Simpsons to each other like it's the basis of all of
there
life.
There are kinds of people who quote things. I am the kind of person who wants to take a thing that I like into myself, as it were, and quote it. For example, whenever I see the word Loretta, how do I hear it in my head? Loretta. Every time. Thomas Hayden Church had a 30-second cameo in Cheers. 30 seconds. And then one of his lines was, "My work is done here."
How many times
have I said that? And Linda, join me. Albania?
Albania, Albania, you border on the Adriatic.
I understand.
Your land is most mountainous, and your chief export is chrome.
Well, see, that's the other thing. When you quoted those people...
This is all
people,
just making me want to watch Cheers, so maybe Linda's right.
When you quoted those people, those two drunk guys in your piece, you quoted two...
Me and Mark Hirsch?
No, it was you and someone else.
So in the piece, let me back it up.
Since you're outing yourself, I'll say it was you, but it was not Mark.
Okay, so let me back it up. All right. So in your piece, you cite these two guys you saw at a party sort of drunkenly kind of saying, "Remember that line about 1840?
No, sitting in a corner for 2 hours.
Right. And you said
bonding.
They said a line. They were quoting a line back and forth. And they were kind of like so drunk that they were getting the line. In fact, they were getting the line wrong. That would never happen, A.
Oh, no. That wasn't the point.
The only criteria we have is getting the line right. That's how we establish nerd hierarchy.
I understand.
But what's happened is...
This is not disproving Linda's...
You've actually just given Linda another arrow.
But this is about...
It's a nerd hierarchy. It's an internal nerd hierarchy. It's
whatever.
Say that it's the most influential thing.
Is there like a... Anybody getting else a high-pitched buzzing sound? Look, here's the thing. I'm talking about quotability of both shows of all shows. Quotability as a metric is about a certain age group. And that age group are the people who right now who are doing a lot of writing about television.
That is so true.
Yeah. And
40-year-old dudes.
40-year-old dudes. So we are 5 years away from having this same bracket being Wizards of Waverly Place versus, you know, The Suite Life of... What
Zach
is it?
Zach and Cody.
What is it? Zach and Cody. Okay, I was going to try to just get near there for a second.
The Suite Life of Zach and Cody.
Like, what is the greatest sitcom of all time?
Because it's The Suite Life of Zach and Cody.
I
believe it's iCarly.
Okay. See, that's it. We're just years from that because that's what's happening. That's the phenomenon you're seeing, Linda, is the culture is being discussed by people who all came of age at this time when The Simpsons was a big thing. And that's why you're seeing it. So I take your point that, you know, when Seitz and all these other people claim that The Simpsons is a cultural monolith, they're talking about their own small thing. But you can say the exact same thing with Cheers. If this same article had been written, these same brackets had been done while Seinfeld was on the air... Oh, my God.
Of course.
With the man hands and the yada, yada, yada.
But this is my whole two things. I have two responses to what you're saying.
Good.
The first one is, if the victory for The Simpsons had been explained in other terms, here's why I think The Simpsons is fundamentally better, then I would not have the same issue with it. My issue with it is its ubiquity and the fact that dudes quote it to each other and that dudes teach their kids to quote it is somehow that means it must be greater. Because all that is taking importance to you, significance to you, sentimental attachment for you, and turning it into the same thing as greatness. So that argument I object to, right?
Okay. It's,
if you wanted to make an argument based on the actual merit of The Simpsons and not the thing that is that actually appears in the piece today that says The Simpsons is, among other things, a public utility. It's really not. It is if you are a particular kind of person.
Of a particular age.
Of course.
And, so, and obviously, we should say, it's not all dudes. I know women who quote The Simpsons as obsessively as I do. And it's not all people my age. But it's fewer. It is, and it is the people who... There's privilege in that.
And I'll go back to my point. It's not about quoting The Simpsons. It's about quoting things. That's a nerd thing.
And see, to me, quoting things... to other people, like, I certainly do it with things that I love.
Right.
But...
to pass for wit.
But unbelievably thick quoting of things is a menace to me. And I got to the point, I mean, you get to the point, like, in college, where you can't listen to one more dude who thinks that because he can quote Monty Python and the Holy Grail from the beginning to the end... that now he has a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And it's I have a very specific reaction to quoting of things. Like, I'll tell you this. Of all the reasons why I love The Princess Bride, the fact that people go around quoting lines from that movie is not any of the reasons. And in fact, you'll remember when I saw The Princess Bride at the AFI, one of the things I said was, go back and see the actual movie, because hearing these things quoted back and forth by people who quote, actually drains them of their life, of their actual artistic vitality. I consider working a quote from the piece of art into something people say to each other to speak a common language, it's effective as speaking a common language. But you're now cut loose from the actual piece of art itself.
Sure.
It's interesting that we've worked up an actual theme of this episode, which is the perils of super fandom.
Yeah.
Yeah. I am a super fan of certain things myself, but I don't necessarily think the behaviors of super fans are in and of themselves indicative of something being great.
Right. And I would consider, I'm a super fan of many things myself. I have quoted many things myself. In 7th and 8th grade, that's pretty much the only language I spoke. But again, you kind of grow out of it. It's kind of training wheels for humor. You see how other people are humorous. You try to glom onto their sense of humor. But ultimately, you do try to adapt it. So what can come off as just trading quotes back and forth is often more nuanced than that. It may not seem like it, in which case, effectively, isn't.
I do it myself. It's just that I don't do it with things. I do it with things that are specific enough that other people don't. Like, the fact that I can quote Sports Night with people would not be my argument for why it's so great.
Sure, but my argument for why Sports Night is so great is the jokes, not the relationships between the characters and the development of the blah, blah, blah. That's all, that's filler between the jokes. For me, I know it can be both. But if I were to come down between the things I like better, I like a well-formed joke than a overarching storyline.
Which Cheers has both.
Cheers has both. And when you were writing about the relationships between Sam and Diane and how it grew, if I had fast-forward today, I would probably be fast-forwarding over a lot of that.
Because the quotes, the jokes.
Well, you can't fast-forward through Cheers, though, because what's so great about Cheers is the way each episode builds.
Understood.
But the point of this is, like, for me, the point of this is not which one is better.
Right.
The point of it is just it's so, looking at how incredibly subjective
that's
it is.
That's exactly
what... That for you, you know, one is better because it has the most repeat-worthy jokes. And for me, the other one is better because having repeat-worthy jokes is not my highest priority for even a comedy.
Right. And I mean, you know, it's easy to understand why you like jokes better than character development, you soulless creature. You.
Glenn likes words better than people.
Jess, could you adjust the levels a little bit? Because I'm still getting that.
up in my left ear.
But I mean, it is absolutely true. I gravitate more towards sitcoms like Roseanne or The Cosby Show, where there is more character storytelling mm-hmm. than I feel like I get from The Simpsons. And believe me, I have watched plenty of Simpsons. Just, this is not just lack after, of exposure.
Just looking after my kids.
I've still only watched that one episode.
It is insanity.
I have watched plenty. Anyway. At any rate, you should come and find us and yell at me on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH.
We basically, by the way, Linda and I and Glenn and Linda disagree with each other by like 5%.
Yeah.
These arguments in the Venn diagram of these arguments, there are slivers on each side.
Nevertheless, come and find us on Facebook and tell me why it's all wrong.
And to reiterate, I think we're all in agreement that this whole bracket exercise was the worst kind of tomfoolery.
Yeah. Well, right, and they would say so too. Yeah. They did
teach me what the term tough bracket means. I'd never known what that meant.
Well, that's my other, I mean, if we were going to take this seriously, you would have to consider the fact that they matched up The Cosby Show against The Simpsons in the first round, right, which should never have happened.
Except it happened every night on television for many years.
Well, no, but as a bracket, you would not do that because those would be like a one and two.
I know
two.
Which choice I would have made.
Come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us what you think about comedy, about superfans, about Kickstarter, and about how great that Veronica Mars movie is going to be.
Absolutely.
If they can make it jumping right from the first season, then I will go and watch it.
See, now you're just baiting people.
I'm only kidding. It was great. It was a very good show. And that brings us to our final segment, What's Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, besides that South by Southwest I felt was a smashing success this year, although my feet still hurt.
Right.
I've decided not to speak about South by Southwest because I have a feeling some people are tired of hearing about it.
Well, if people who can look up all your tweets.
Yes, you can follow me on Twitter and read about what I thought. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to talk about a story that several people have clued me into in the last, I guess, 2 weeks now that I do want to make sure everybody knows about, which is the story of the guy named Mike Mika. It could be Mika, M-I-K-A, who is a Donkey Kong fan. And his little daughter was playing Donkey Kong and expressed her sadness that the boy Wazo is saving the girl. So he apparently has some programming skills.
Yeah, apparently.
And reprogrammed the game in such a way that Mario is stranded up at the top by the ape and carried away by the ape.
Uh-huh.
And Pauline is jumping through all the various obstacles, jumping over barrels and dodging fire and whatnot, in order to save Mario. And as the father of a 9-year-old girl who loves Donkey Kong, it made me want to acquire that version of the game, and B, just it's just heartwarming. I mean, it's just
quite heartwarming.
It's such a cute.
It's totally like a World's Most Awesome Dad story.
Yeah, I thought like, man, A, you think, why didn't I think of that? And B, because I can't do it. But I just thought it was awesome, coolest dad ever.
Excellent. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Well, as I tweeted last night, as I was about 3/4 of the way through it, I am very happy that I finally caught up with Pitch Perfect. I would just like to echo every good thing that Linda Holmes has said about this movie, which is sort of a woman-powered movie about funny women, and it's just fantastic and funny and warm and a little off-kilter, and I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Wonderful.
And also on the topic of funny women, coming up on April 9th, it is Carol Burnett Night on PBS.
Aww.
2 hours of vintage PBS programming about one of the most successful funny women of the 20th and now the 21st centuries. There's an American Master special, 90 minutes long, plus a half-hour special called Carol Burnett and the Funny Ladies, in which other funny ladies talk about her and her influence. And I wanted to highlight this because with the exception of, say, American Idol and maybe Smash, which isn't very good, but they spend a lot of money on it, there is nothing on TV that has the scale of the Carol Burnett Show anymore. This was a live variety show with a 28-piece orchestra, 12 dancers, new costumes every week, guest stars, two major, you know, sort of celebrity guest stars every single week who are getting paid, not there to pimp some new project. And if you're younger than I am, if you're younger than some of us in this room are, and you haven't dug up Carol Burnett and her amazing variety show on DVD, you need to get thee to the shopping venue of thy choice.
Oh, and that show was so funny.
Oh, yeah.
You talk about great jokes.
Just gut-bustingly funny. And if you have never seen a great example of what theater people call corpsing, which is, you know, making each other laugh on stage and,
oh, yeah, I know
and
exactly
losing the plot.
No, exactly what you're talking
about. Long before Jimmy Fallon.
So that, at a minimum, watch this PBS special because you have no idea what you're missing if you're not intimately familiar with the work of Carol Burnett. Also check out Moon Over Broadway, which is a can't look away documentary about how the show that was supposed to be her triumphant return to Broadway. It was a Ken Ludwig backstage farce called Moon Over Buffalo. It went so far off the rails that they called in a dentist from Long Island to punch up the jokes.
Yes, wow. I remember that story.
This is a Pennybaker documentary.
Yes, that's why.
And it's available on DVD.
Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
I just got back from Barcelona, a very beautiful city, a very walkable city, I know, because we walked an average of 7 miles a day. So go there. But that doesn't give you a pop culture product that you can enjoy. When a coworker at my day job found out we were going to Barcelona, she handed me a novel called The Shadow of the Wind by a Barcelonian writer, novelist.
It's that Patrick Swayze song, right?
First novelist. who now, the guy that actually lives in California, his name is Carlos Ruiz Zafón, Z-A-F-O-N. It's set in Barcelona in the 50s. When this book was published over here in the U.S. in 2005, it was pretty big. It was a bestseller, got rave reviews from The Post and Entertainment Weekly and places like that. And I kept my distance from it because it was called over and over again a love letter to literature. And I was like, oh, boy, here we go.
Who do the movies?
It's about an antiquarian book dealer and his son. And in the very first chapter, the son finds the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. And there's a whole...
Whole
thing about the smell of the page and the field.
And Linda's out.
And it's so, like, you get hit in the face with this preciousness, this very self-serious, self-conscious, you know, fetishistic literature. I love literature. Very performative literature thing. There's a map in it, which you think would get me, but it's a map of Barcelona, and it's clearly put in by the publisher for, like, the book group so they can kind of go, and here is where Daniel meets the man with the burned face, you know, by this fountain. And I was like, oh, and I was like, dude, you just gave me literary fanny pack is what you just gave me. This might as well have Rick Steves' face stamped on it with a big thumbs up, you know? Not that there's anything wrong with Rick Steves, but it's like, this is like, what are you doing to me? But I make the promise, I give everything 50 pages in, and I start it, and it's all this very florid, melodramatic prose. At one point, she turned from me, lips trembling, eyes poisoned with tears. Like, oh, God, what are you doing to me? Now, 50 pages in, it might have helped if you read this book sitting in a cafe as you watch the last light of the setting sun. Limn, I say.
Ew.
The neo-Gothic spires of the Barcelona Cathedral, while you're also admittedly two or three vino tintos into the evening. But this book grabbed me. This book totally sold me. I mean, I was there. You're atmospheric, and everything is just... It's this... It has this amazing sense of place. It has this crazy plot where people who keep meeting each other that they shouldn't meet have exactly the piece of information that will reveal the dark buried secret of Barcelona's past. And is it sort of travel porn? Yes. Is it florid and melodramatic? Yes. But I ate it up with a spoon.
Wonderful. Ooh.
The Shadow of the Wind.
The Shadow of the Wind.
can I add
another? Wait, is that the love theme from Mulan?
No.
Trey, go ahead.
Oh, I had a similar recommendation. When I was in Florence, I read a book called The Monster of Florence.
Oh, I've read that book.
A true crime book. It's kind of related to the story of Hannibal Lecter, and it was kind of the inspiration in part for the Thomas Harris books. But I read it when I was there, and it was kind of awesome,
walking around
seeing these places.
I had a similar experience. I was walking through a urine-soaked alley in Austin, Texas last week. No.
I did at some point actually turn to Faust after we'd learned all the stuff about everything, and I was just like... By the way, that's where Daniel met the man with the burned face.
Nice. All right. I decided that this week for What's Making Me Happy, I would give you a Sublime and a Ridiculous. Awesome. The Sublime is not exactly making me happy, but really, really good, and I recommend it highly. I'm about the last person to tell you that This American Life recently did 2 episodes from a Chicago high school called Harper High, where they've had a lot of gun violence, which was the original motivator for them to do the episodes, was that they had had a large number of shootings of students in the previous year. So this past fall, they spent an entire semester on location at this school in the social worker's office with the teachers, with the kids. And in addition to having a lot of insight about gun violence, these two episodes also have a lot of insight about poverty, about gangs, about the struggle of people like teachers and other adults to try to be a durable presence for kids who have a lot of vulnerabilities, but who also have very often parents who are trying, you know, very hard also to do their best for them. They're really wonderful episodes, and they're just called Harper High School Part 1 and Part 2. They are just a handful of episodes back on the This American Life website, and I really do recommend them. They're sort of hard to listen to, but they're not, you know, they're also very interesting and lively, and I highly recommend them. They will make you a bigger fan of radio journalism than perhaps you already are. So that's the sublime. Here's the ridiculous. Stephen Thompson, while you were in Austin, I watched the 2-hour premiere of Hell's Kitchen. Because out of loyalty.
Thank you. The risotto is not cooked!
And there is a lady on Hell's Kitchen who has a puppet.
What's the matter with you? It's a nicer place.
I'm trying to study, and there's a random chef puppet having conversations with me and my other roommates. I don't know what to do about it.
My name is Alfredo Al Dente.
I like the sausage, baby, over here.
Oh.
It's fairly amazing in the sense that you sit down, you think Hell's Kitchen has nothing more to give in terms of absurdity, and then you see the offensive Italian puppet. And I missed you so much in that moment.
It's a me, Mario Batali.
Well, you know what? If it provides, I have not seen these episodes yet. If it provides a break from the confessionals on that show, in which people are yelling for some reason.
Well, and all they do in that show is yell and smoke. So someone had to bring a puppet, and finally, someone did. So that's my ridiculous. I've got the sublime and the ridiculous, and that is what's making me happy this week.
Nice.
You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our esteemed producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. And you can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. By the way, for Mike Katziff fans, you can hear him on one of the All Songs Considered late night dispatches that we will link to.
We put Team Tomcat back together.
Exactly.
One last score.
You can hear the voice of Mike Katziff. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are listening to right now. Thanks to all of you guys for being here. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
And you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.